This is the Adam Gold Show.
All right, we got a lot of things to do. Shane Ryan of Golf Digest is going to join us. PGA Championship this week. Also, his new book is out about the Ryder Cup. We talked to him before the Ryder Cup in the fall, the Ryder Cup that the U.S. couldn't lose, and that was sort of had a double meaning to it. As it turned out, they didn't lose because they were simply better and more prepared than the European side. But the roots of that really go back all the way to 2014 and a devastating post-Ryder Cup press conference with Phil Mickelson eviscerating then-captain Tom Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Shane wrote about it then and then wrote the book this go-round, and we'll talk to Shane about Mickelson's impact in the Ryder Cup, and then we'll talk a little bit about what's going on with Phil right now, which ain't a whole lot. But right now it's time for the Wall of Sound. Patrick Beverley undressed a future Hall of Famer, and it's time to listen.
The Wall of Sound is a function of this studio. There's no doubt about it.
All right, let's start with Patrick Beverley.
Yes, please.
The Phoenix Suns won 64 games this year. Chris Paul was great. Devin Booker was great. The supporting cast on that team was great. And then they get to Game 7, and it was like, I can't even explain. There was nothing. It was worse than that. It was worse than that. Patrick Beverley noted, I mean, he is the guy that just mucks it up. He is a clown, in my opinion, but he is an effective agitator as an NBA player. And he was on ESPN today, and he had nothing good to say about Chris Paul. He likened his defense to essentially something that does not move.
True. He's not lying about
that. CP can't guard nobody, man. Everybody in the NBA know that. Everybody
know
that.
He can't guard anybody.
What we call a cone. You know what you do with cones? Like when in the summertime, you got a cone. You make a move. What does the cone do?
Stay still.
Exactly. Yeah. He's a cone. Stop playing, man. Everybody knows that. Everyone knows that. It's just y'all don't want to accept it.
Patrick Beverley brought the heat. And here's this is actually like whether Chris Paul is a bad defender or not, who cares? I don't know that he's that bad a defender. Anyway, Beverley did offer this, which I think has some merit.
First off, I know a lot of them, I'm going to get a lot for this, but, you know, I don't really care. They benched the wrong person. Should have benched Chris. And I'm not saying bench him now. Once you see they starting attacking Chris early, and you know that might become a problem later on, you need to see how my team works without Chris in the game a little bit. I got benched. We won, though.
Right.
So
right.
You don't even remember that.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So as a coach, you have to understand, like, man, I have to understand they're attacking my main guy. I can't get buckets from him. I have to make an adjustment, whatever that adjustment is. And that's no fault against Monty. He's a great coach of the year. But T. Lou, if T. Lou's there, he's making that decision. It's a hard decision, but he's making it.
He's benching Chris Paul in game 7.
Not benching him, but spurts here. We got to see something else. I mean, apparently it didn't work.
Acknowledging that it has become a problem, and despite his stature, I'm just making sure I'm understanding, despite his stature in the game.
Coach the game, not the player.
There's a lot of truth to that. Beverley did back off, bench him. He backed off that part. But can I just say that throughout all of this, when Patrick Beverley says, I've been benched, yeah, and?
Yeah.
Like, you are a good defender, more of an agitator than a defender, but a good defender. But you ain't doing anything for offense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you've been benched. Because there are many nights where you're no good. Now, Chris Paul was no good yesterday.
No.
That was really, really, really awful. All right, on the other side of that is the winning team. Luka Doncic, who had heard for years that not only him, but his team was not good enough. And there was a lot of trash talk in this series, most of which Luka was dishing out. Here's Luka.
For me, it seemed like trash talking. It gets me going. It's It's another motivational stuff. It gets us going, and everybody was talking about it even before the game won. You know, nobody picked us, so it was motivational for us.
Yeah. Look, I thought Dallas was going to be good in the postseason. Mm-hmm. Did I think that they were going to beat Phoenix going into this series? No. But Dallas is a different team the last month of the regular season and into the playoffs. And when you have a guy like Luka who can get you games on his own, mm-hmm. you know, perfect storm yesterday. Phoenix was bad, but Dallas obviously did a lot of that. But he is so, so good. Giannis Antetokounmpo had a chance to win game six. They did not do it. And I think, and then they go to game seven, they get beat. Boston as a team was better than Milwaukee as a team. Boston, second half of the year, was arguably the best team in the league anyway. So nobody should be that surprised. But Giannis, who is so much fun to listen to after games, he is so insightful, and had some, it's not really advice, but thoughts on the experience, even for the team that beat him.
But like at the end of the day, like this is a learning curve, like you know, like the steps to it, you know. And also for Boston, you know, the one 2008, you know, now if they're gonna win again, who knows. But at the end of the day, like, you know, for this young, amazing, talented team, you know, they've had the ups and downs. They've been in the Eastern Conference Finals, they wasn't able to get through. They've been in the second round, not able to get through. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals. Like, it's learning experience for them. You know, it might not be, they might not win it all, but they won that season. You know, nobody promised you're going to be in the second round. There's people that have never been in the second round. There's people that have never been in the NBA Finals.
Look, here's the thing about Giannis. He has such an interesting perspective on all of these things, about staying in the moment. There was a clip from last year which went viral, just how grounded he is. But what he's trying to get across there is that there just are no guarantees about anything. Doesn't matter if you're the favorite or an underdog. I mean, all you could do is give it your best. I think Milwaukee did that last night. He did go on to say that, you know, could it have been different with Chris Middleton? He was very quick to say it's not an excuse. And I didn't take it as an excuse. But we should remember that they didn't have their second best player. And they couldn't replace him.
Yeah.
And when it got down to game seven, Grayson Allen was bad. Mm-hmm. Bobby Portis was just okay. They didn't get much out of Pat Connaughton. And I don't believe that as great as Giannis is, Giannis and Brooks Lopez are going to do it. They weren't good enough. And you had Boston just careering it.
Yeah.
Did you see what Boston shot? How many threes Boston shot yesterday?
About 700.
55.
Yeah.
They were 22 of 55. What? Huh? 55 threes?
That's ridiculous.
That is ridiculous. All right. To the head coach of the Carolina Hurricanes. It's a whole new world, isn't it? The Hurricanes as favorites. The Hurricanes as expected to win team. Here's Brindamore.
It's such a different feeling coming into this one. You know, I think back in the other ones, it was like, you know, if we would have won, you guys might have been a little surprised. You know, like this time around, I felt like it was our time, you know, and you know, our guys have matured, and I think they felt that too. So, you know, obviously happy for everybody.
He sounds thrilled for everybody. Rod did say that the enjoyment he gets is watching the players, you know, feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. And I get it. It's also validation for what Rod has built here.
Yeah.
So, in year one, they surprised by getting to the conference finals. In year two, we ended up in the bubble. Mm-hmm. I don't think Carolina was as good in year two as they were in year one.
No.
They beat the Rangers in the qualifying round, then lost the Bruins in five. Last year, won the division, with Florida and Tampa in it. Got to struggled with Nashville, but won that series in six games. And then fell to the Lightning in five. Series could have been a little different. I mean, Carolina was right there in game one, didn't get good goaltending. Had a lead in game four after winning game three in Tampa. Looked like they might be able to even that series. Didn't work out. But ultimately, they lost to a much better team, the eventual champs. This year, Carolina, pretty much start to finish, was one of the best three or four teams in the entire league. Start to finish. They're the favorites going into their second round series against the Rangers. It's a lot of progress that they have made in 4 years. When we come back, Shane Ryan, Golf Digest, author, PGA is this week. The book is called The Cup They Couldn't Lose. And how does Phil Mickelson play a role in all of this? We'll talk to Shane Ryan about that next. PGA starts on Thursday. Shane Ryan, Golf Digest, noted author, will be there, but he's not there yet, which is great because we get to talk to him not only about his book, The Cup They Couldn't Lose, which we spoke to him about as he was going through the process, but we'll talk to him about just a couple of other things surrounding the PGA Tour. And he joins us on the Adam Gold Show. You can follow him on Twitter at Shane Ryan here. First of all, I trust the book is doing great because I know how you are as a writer. And anybody who is interested at all in the Ryder Cup will love everything that went into this. How you doing?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. I'm doing good. I think the book is doing well, as far as I know. Yeah, the feedback has been really good so far. So, you know, it's been gratifying. And like you said, I mean, this is it's a great event. It's one that I've loved for a really long time. And, you know, the hope is when you write a book like that, the passion you have for it kind of translates onto the page and, you know, becomes infectious and people enjoy reading it.
I listened to the companion podcast, and I think I told you that I've gone back and listened to episodes again. And your love for Paul McGinley is probably irrational and should be checked by law enforcement. All right, so let me ask you about the impetus for, I guess, the angst, the and maybe the change, because it kind of ties into somebody who is front and center in golf issues today, and that's Phil Mickelson. How did we get started with all of this because of Mickelson at Glen Eagles in 2014?
Yeah, I think so. I think that was a huge part of it. I mean, this is a long time coming. You talk about my book, there are basically two main stories in this book. The first one is, how did Europe come to dominate the Ryder Cup, right?
Right.
How did they do it starting in the 80s with Tony Jacklin when they never had, you know, the players that America had? Those guys weren't as high in the world rankings. They didn't have as many majors. So that's story one. And story two, as you were alluding to, is, you know, after enduring 30 years of humiliation at the hands of the Europeans, how did America then figure it out? And yeah, Glen Eagles really is the fulcrum point. It was not only a big European win, but just really dysfunctional and embarrassing on the American side. Phil Mickelson afterward goes and basically calls out Tom Watson and the entire Ryder Cup system. You know, he says, why don't we do what Paul Azinger did, you know, when he won in 2008. It seems like that was a really good plan. Why don't we do that anymore? And from that, the Ryder Cup Task Force was born. Guys like Davis Love, Steve Stricker, Jim Furyk, future captains. And they really took a serious look for the first time at the Ryder Cup as a team event. And they say, why is Europe beat us? What are they doing? What do they know? What are some of their tactics and things like that? And, you know, in the book, it kind of gets into how they reversed this sort of huge historical momentum. And, you know, in my opinion, especially after this Whistling Straits blowout, kind of redefined, you know, who's the top dog in the Ryder Cup.
Shane Ryan is joining us here on the Adam Gold Show at Shane Ryan here on Twitter. I have always been of the mind that, like, it really boils down to who makes putts more than anything else, and it's difficult to convince me otherwise. But you took it to a different place in your research. Why is it more than that?
You know, I think the best analogy I can give is if you were looking at basketball teams and you would say, Well, it's really just down to which team makes more shots. Well, yeah, that's true, right? The scoreboard reflects which team makes more baskets. But the coaching, right, the coaching and the strategy and everything sets the team up to make baskets. So that's an easy sell in basketball because we've all played it. We know it's a team sport. It's a harder sell in golf because golf, what we know of it, what we 99% of the golf we watch is individual. And so, and some of the Ryder Cup is individual too. And so you look at that and you say, well, it's still just an individual sport. But as it turns out, and the reason, you know, Europe won this thing so many times with lesser talent, it really is a team event. And there are things you can do to set up your players to play as best as possible. You know, just to pluck an example from history, you know, Hal Sutton was the captain in 2004, and he had this idea to put Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson together. Well, on paper, yeah, like, how could that go wrong? At the time, they were the number one and number two players in the world. They're both legends. But as it turned out, they don't really like each other. They play different balls, and so it was really uncomfortable in this case for Phil Mickelson to play with Tiger Woods' Nike ball. You know, Phil had just undergone an equipment change, so his head wasn't in the right place. Basically, there were a million things he should have thought about that made this look like a really bad idea. And as it turned out, you know, they lost twice, and the U.S. got pretty much murdered in that Ryder Cup. So it's just things like that. It can go really, really in-depth, the amount of stuff a captain has to do. But essentially, if you're not thinking of it as a team sport, you're setting up your players to lose.
Yeah, it's funny. I always push back on the, when it comes to professional athletes, which team wants it more, which is the most knuckle dragging, lowest common denominator emotion in sports. But it does seem that in this particular competition, there was more motivation from one side than the other. It's the difference between trying to achieve something versus trying to protect something. Is that fair?
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I learned a lot during the research of this, which was really hard for me to understand, and I think it's hard for most Americans to understand, is that we come from a huge country with an unbelievable population of great athletes, right, in every sport. And so we would never look at the Ryder Cup and say, boy, this is our chance to really stick it to Europe or to stick it to England or something like that. On the other side, America is this looming, like, juggernaut, this behemoth. And so that is its own motivation. You know, for someone from the UK, for someone from France, for someone from Sweden, they look at this as, like, these guys are the top dog, and this is our chance to show who we are on a national stage. And beating America just has that extra special flavor for them that it wouldn't for us. And that was particularly true when you looked at when Europe started to turn the Ryder Cup around. You know, on the U.S. side, Davis Love is a great example. Coming up and playing, the Ryder Cup wasn't a big deal to him. The first time he made a Ryder Cup team, it was kind of like, so what? This was not one of his career goals. Well, things have changed dramatically because the young guys now, when you're looking at Scottie Scheffler, Spieth, Thomas, Cantlee, Shoffley, on and on, they grew up watching the U.S. get beat in the Ryder Cup in these really passionate events. And so it's a whole different mindset for them. They really want to go out and win. And, yeah, I think that passion is something you need. I don't think it's underrated at all. And you know, it's another sort of historical accident that America has it now.
Interesting, as I transition, Davis Love, as a rookie in 93, sunk the winning putt that gave the cup back, helped retain the cup because they had won it in 91, but that was the last time that the United States has won on foreign soil back at Belfry. All right, I am curious, as you get to Southern Hills, Shane Ryan, and there is no Phil Mickelson there, how big of an absence is that really, or are we dealing with this is just a storyline that we can't follow because he would have been the oldest ever major champion a year ago, and he's simply not there to defend?
Yeah, you know, I certainly can't think of another example where you've had a defending champion of a major who is not injured, who is able to play, who didn't come back and defend. And when you combine that strange little fact with everything that's gone on since, everything with the LIV Golf Tour and Saudi Arabia and all the drama surrounding Phil Mickelson, yeah, like the honest truth is, in the lead up to the week before we start playing any golf, that is going to be the number one story. There's really just no way around it. You know, Tiger Woods will be 1B or 1A or whatever, but, you know, Phil not playing with how much he's been in the news is enormous. And there's no way around it.
Do you think he's not playing because of Phil Mickelson or because of some unspoken because they will never speak of it, PGA Tour suspension?
So the PGA Championship is run by the PGA
right.
of America, so it's a little different. They, you know, take it for what it's worth. They said in the statement, he was invited.
Yep.
We wanted to have him, you know, and so and that so their thing is it's not us. They tried to make that really clear. So, you know, I think this is about Phil. You're hearing rumors and rumors that basically he's been playing locally and shooting in the high 70s, and so he thinks that he'll embarrass himself. And you know, with Phil right now, with how much notoriety he has in the last few months, there's a lot at stake. I mean, if he goes and shoots 78-78 and gets cut, that's extra humiliating, right? I mean, in a normal year, you'd go, well, yeah, sure, he's a 50-something-year-old golfer, whatever. But in this year, people would pile on. And so my guess would be there's a part of him that doesn't want to expose himself to that, especially if he doesn't feel that he's playing very well.
Or does he just not want to answer questions about the Live series or the $40 million worth of gambling losses that have been reported in Alan Shipnuck's book? Not to talk about another book, but I mean that's yeah, obvious. Yeah. That's obviously there too. Is he just trying to delay the inevitable conversations?
Yeah, I think that's probably definitely part of it. Is that yeah? What positive interaction could he have with the media at this point this week? But, you know, that could only go poorly. He would either end up saying something stupid like Greg Norman, like, oh, we all make mistakes, you know,
gosh,
a bone saw yep. slipped out of my hand. And no, but, you know, I don't think there's any from a media, from a PR perspective, for sure. There's no benefit to him talking to anybody. And it would be really hard to escape that going to a major championship where your name is, you know, in the top of the news. So there's that. I still think he would probably like to have played if he felt he was playing well, but, you know, add all those ingredients together, and it probably was an easy choice for him.
Tiger Woods kind of came back into golf following a press conference where he basically had to bare his soul. Does Mickelson have to do that before he plays?
You know, trying to map out, okay, how does it work where in 4 years Phil Mickelson is back in our good graces and we all love him again? Very, very hard to imagine that path. I think it would call for the kind of atonement and yeah, sort of confessional nature that I don't think is in his nature to do. He's too arrogant for that. He thinks he's too smart for that. I just don't see this going back. And then you also just look at the trajectory of somebody's life. It feels like things are falling apart for Phil Mickelson now. To me, again, who knows what happens? And this is not a prediction, but just looking at it from the outside, this doesn't feel like a story that's on a track for a happy ending for me. It seems like with the gambling debts and with the Saudi Arabia stuff and things about Phil's personality are catching up with him in a big way. So for me, it's hard to see how that would happen where he's, you know, the nation's beloved champion again.
We'll have to leave it there. It's clear that this whole thing was a money grab for everybody. Phil Mickelson, Greg Norman, and they never thought the entire thing through. But I hope Phil can come back from this. I really do. He's fun for golf, and he's incredibly popular. I don't know how popular he is among current players these days. I think that has definitely waned. I hope the book does great, Shane. The Cup They Couldn't Lose, will they win it in Italy in a year and a half?
I think yes. I think the time has come. I think 30 years is 30 years of losing on the road will be over. I think it's. I think they're ready for it.
I agree with you. Plus, the team looks awfully stacked. Even as we're about 18 months out. At Shane Ryan here on Twitter. I thank you very much for your time, sir. Enjoy Southern Hills and talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot, Adam.
You got it. I encourage if you're interested at all in the Ryder Cup, The companion podcast is also very good, which tells a lot of stories that are in the book. But it's a phenomenal read. Shane's an outstanding writer.
This is the Adam Gold Show.